Hello and welcome back to Inside Total Film. I'm Jane Crowther, Editor-in-Chief of Total Film, and I've got with me today Matt Matem.
Hello.
And also Matthew Leyland.
Hello.
And this episode we'll be taking a look at The Invisible Man, Portrait of a Lady on Fire and Dark Waters. Plus, rising star George Mackay tells us all about his new film, True History of Kelly Gang. First up, he's behind you, or is he?
Adrian.
He was a sociopath.
He said that I could never leave him.
He controlled how I looked and what I wore. Then it was controlling when I left the house. And eventually, what I thought. I'm sorry, I can't take you with me. I'm not gonna leave you with that thing on.
Okay, so that was The Invisible Man. We gave it 4 stars. I didn't see it because I was trapped in an airport on Gran Canaria in a sandstorm, but you guys did. What's the difference with this film? How is it different from the previous Invisible Men films we've seen before?
There's a man and he's invisible.
So that's good.
Yep, but other than that, yeah, it has very little to do with the H.G. Wells book. But for one thing, the protagonist is not the Invisible Man. It's Elizabeth Moss's Cecilia, who's in an abusive relationship with her boyfriend, who then apparently dies, but then she seems to be stalked by something beyond the grave.
Does this play around with whether or not she is actually experiencing some sort of post-traumatic stress, or it's really a thing, or does it actually go to the point of sort of saying that he is now invisible? How does it sort of treat us as audience? Are we guessing as well?
No, I mean, that was one slight issue I had with it, is that it is clear from that she's not crazy, that right. He is in fact an invisible man. It's all the people
there's
around
no ambiguity
her.
On this.
No, I think maybe they could have had a bit of that. They could have played with that for a little while, which they don't really, but all the characters around her are wondering if she's gone a bit gaga.
Yeah, that metaphor was definitely there, but the film and as the audience, you know that she's not insane.
Okay, so this is like a feminist twist on this, and it's really kind of exciting to see that. Does it work? We gave it 4 stars. Why is it a 4-star film? What works about this?
Well, it's really tense and quite scary. I guess that relevance, we're saying the fact it feels like an abusive relationship, although there's not that ambiguity there, there's still very much that parallel, and she's escaped this relationship with this horrible husband she had, and he's just continuing to torment her, and it plays it very straight. And the fact that just the idea of someone invisible that you can't see tormenting you, it's just such a horrible
How does she get tormented? What does he do?
I won't say too much, because obviously how it escalates is interesting, and you kind of want to see it for yourself. It starts off with smaller things, like just little things she'll be toying with, and
there's a frying pan incident.
Yeah, there's a frying pan incident, and there's a moment very early on where she's going for a job interview, and then she opens her portfolio and everything's been taken out of there.
Yeah.
So just little things like that, and where she's questioning herself a bit, and having escaped this traumatic relationship, she's obviously still feeling the effects of that, and I guess she's questioning it early on. It's never really explained, but he's an expert in optics. That's how he made his billion.
Okay, I was just going to say, how has he become invisible? And why has he become invisible? Well, just to torment her? Or is that a twist? Am I delving into spoiler territory?
No, not really. It does seem pretty much that's
It's a power trip, I think, for him, really.
And they kind of talk about him as a real narcissist, and he's just basically concocted this huge scheme just because this woman didn't want him, and so he can't accept that, and he's going to make her pay for it, basically.
But it is very much about her. Like, you don't find out a great deal about him. It's all about her. Well, she's in pretty much every shot, so it's all from her perspective. It's her psychology. So
I mean, it must have been quite
a bit of a misnomer, really.
And it must have been quite an easy role for Oliver Jackson.
Oh, God,
Cohen.
Yeah. It's the easiest role ever.
Previously been seen in The Haunting of Hill House on Netflix. But he's barely in it, obviously, because
he's invisible.
I don't know how much motion capture pajama stuff he did, but he's barely in it.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the woman at the centre of this. It's obviously played by Elizabeth Moss. We love her in Handmaid's Tale. And she's obviously really trying to do projects that do explore female roles, female position within a patriarchal society and within a sort of patriarchal relationship. How is she in this? Is she as good as she is in Handmaid's?
Yeah, she's great. Yeah. I mean, she really brings that emotional intensity, that psychological intensity. I mean, she just never drops the ball all the way through it and kind of keeps you on board with it. It is quite a grounded film. There's not much emphasis on science fiction, really. Mm. But it is obviously a leap of faith to accept this idea of an invisible person. But she keeps you believing in it, that there is this presence stalking her all the time.
And she really brings a class to it, doesn't she? And I think like a lesser actor, totally, perhaps the whole film would have not work quite so well, but you just really buy her in it, and she just really sells the whole thing, really.
So is this something that people who enjoy The Invisible Man and sort of scary movies will enjoy, or is it more of a psychological drama? Does it still give you the bumps in the night, the bang?
Oh yeah, there's some real shock moments in it, and it is bloody scary, especially for the first half. Yeah.
There's some very nicely done invisible set pieces and things as well, so it's an enjoyable night out.
The sound design's really effective,
just very tense with it, not for the faint-hearted.
No, not at all.
So how does this end? I mean, is there a springboard for more Invisible Man movies after this? What goes on at the end of this?
Yeah, you could say that. I mean, certainly the issue Matt and I had is that you kind of see something that happens, but it's not clear how it happens, if you see what I mean. It will leave you with questions. Yeah, potentially, yeah.
We both saw it last night in the cinema, and I wish I could have just rewound it and checked something out, because it didn't quite entirely add up for me at the end. But it's left on an intriguing note, and it definitely leaves you feeling potentially there could be more out there. But it was almost just a slightly illogical ending that just slightly left me feeling slightly befuddled.
Is that why you knock the star off the 5-star rating? The ending loses it?
Yeah, maybe.
Perhaps it does become a little bit more formulaic as it goes on in some ways.
Okay. Well, obviously, we won't give away the ending here. So do go and see that this Friday and let us know what you think of the ending. Did it work? Did it hang together? Was it just these two mats that were confused in the cinema and didn't realise what was happening?
Yeah. I genuinely always live in fear when I don't quite understand something. Yeah. And I think, am I just an idiot?
Because you're thick.
Probably,
All right, let's move on. Let's talk about you and your meeting with George Mackay earlier this week. He obviously has made a huge splash in 1917. He's key to that film really succeeding. And now he's in The True History of the Kelly Gang, Justin Kurzel's sort of return to his Australian roots after the sort of not so great reception for Assassin's Creed. Yep. Tell me a little bit about where you met George and this film.
George was in London at a swanky hotel to talk about True History of the Kelly Gang. And he stars as Ned Kelly in this film, the famous Australian outlaw. And it's kind of a punk rock take, you could say, on this outlaw myth and how people become the myth that they're told that they are. And George kind of says it much more eloquent than me. So shall we throw it to the interview now?
Yes. I hope you asked him about wearing dresses and being in a punk band.
I did.
Great. Let's listen to that.
I'm delighted to welcome George Mackay to Inside Total Film. George, welcome. Hello. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you've probably recently seen George in Sam Mendes' award season favourite 1917. And next up, he's starring in True History of the Kelly Gang, directed by Justin Kurzel, in which he plays Ned Kelly. So firstly, George, could you give our listeners a sense of Justin Kurzel's approach to this Ned Kelly story?
Yeah, to Justin's approach. I guess it depends what people know about Ned Kelly, like who he was. He's an Australian outlaw and bushranger and a famous figure, kind of a bit like Australia's Jesse James or Robin Hood. So basically, Justin, his approach to the character and to this story is to let go of the history and to embrace the spirit of it and to kind of make the film that he feels the Kelly Gang would make, which is a bunch of angry, ambitious, confused young men, and to make it in that spirit, that punk spirit, and to play with the legend that is already established, at least in Australia. So that is his approach. So it's kind of punk, it's brutal, it's sexy, it's strange, it's very Australian as well. So, you know, with that gallows humour, it's a lot of things all at once.
And what kind of knowledge of Ned Kelly did you bring before this kind of came to you?
Well, my dad's Australian, my dad's from Adelaide. Yeah. So I knew of Ned, in a sense, the point of the film. So like, I knew of Ned as the symbol. I knew Ned as a kind of, as a famous figure. I knew him for the famous helmet, you know, the Kelly Gang are known for in their last stand, what's called the Kelly Gang's last stand at Glenrowan. They built their own bulletproof armour out of plough blades. And this is, you know, the story set in the 1870s. So they made bulletproof armour out of plough blades and this particular famous helmet that's got like a letterbox eye hole and went out against, you know, tons of police, the four of them with, you know, guns blazing. So I knew that. I knew the helmet and I knew the name. So I didn't know much more than that. But when the script came in, the character felt so right in a way, and something I wanted so much. Firstly, just because I'm such a fan of Justin's work, yeah, and have been since Snowtown and Macbeth, but also because my dad's Australian, and a few years ago I got talking to my dad in a way that I'd never talked to him before, and was asking him about his past, which, because he came across to England when he was 21, our family's always been quite distant, you know, geographically. And I don't know much about my dad's childhood because it's not tangible in a physical sense. And as I'm at that age where you know, beyond teenage years, when you sort of, as a young man, go into a different stage of adulthood and you're trying to kind of suss out what you want, how you want to be, what you want to do, who you are, and all of that stuff, I was kind of looking at where I was from as well. And a big part of that is my dad is a big meter of how I am.
That's what I was just going to say, kind of hearing you say that, it very much does tie to the theme of the film, because the whole thing is Ned's kind of basically addressing his son and kind of setting out what he wants him to know about him, really.
In this, Justin also has, I think, the cleverness of the film, it's a double layer. And when we were talking about 1917 doing promotion for that, what was beautiful is it's got this double layer of the big and the small. And that's, this film has got it as well, is that you're looking at one man's identity struggle, which is surrounded by his family, which is surrounded by the context, social context, which is surrounded by the world that Justin's created for the film. And it also kind of comments on Australia as well, and a national identity, and it, which I think is also a very prevalent theme at the minute, where all across the world, different countries, including our own, you know, here in the UK, are trying to sort of understand what it is that is us. And rightly or wrongly, you hold on to certain elements that you feel the thing that you want to be or that you think that you are. What have you based that on?
Yeah.
Like, who is the man? Why did you choose to base it on that? And actually, the thing that you said he was he even that? Because you don't even know, because this film is about someone going, no, I'm trying to tell you what I am, but you're not allowing me to say it. So I'm going to become the thing that you say that I am. And ironically, after it's all kind of come out in the wash, you've said I'm something completely different.
I heard Justin had some interesting things for you guys to bond. Can you sort of say a bit about that?
I got cast in the summer of 2017, it was, and we were looking to film the beginning of 2018. And Justin, what's amazing about Justin is that he offers the opportunity to really go in and stuff and really commit. And I was really hungry to do that myself, you know, as an actor, to try to really go at something, you know, really give it my all. You know, the things that you hear about when you went, you know, like you hear it, I know it's kind of thrown about, but like a Daniel Day-Lewis or something, they went, oh my God, he became that for a year. And I think it pays off in the work. Like, you see it, and it's sort of something that's sometimes poked fun at, but also he's the best actor around. Like, you know, he's like, the work is so good. And Justin was like, I want you to come out to Australia. I want you to write every day as Ned. He's a wordsmith. He's trying to articulate himself. Poems, plays, diaries, whatever it is. Write, write, write. He gave me pages of Aussie films to watch to understand Aussie culture and humour. Aussie songs, a lot of Aussie musicians, a lot of punk music as well, Aussie punk, a lot of books on the history of Australia, the colonial history, which sort of went off into the Indigenous history as well, history about Ned Kelly. And he said, I want you to learn how to ride a horse. I want you to change how your body looks. I want him to look a certain way. I want you to do all of these things so you soak in this character. So I basically went to Australia. I went and saw my family first, which I hadn't seen for a long, long time. I hadn't been back to Australia for 9 years. Oh, wow. And I went to Australia and spent 3 months out there, made some amazing friends through another dear friend, and lived on a farm for a while, and, you know, rode horses and was around horses and just getting your hands dirty, basically. Yeah. And had a bunch of amazing life experiences which were formative to the character and to myself, which most of them aren't literally in the film. I went to Tasmania and chopped wood. I lived with Justin and Essie, and we were talking through the script. And then when we came out there, the biggest thing that he said, so it's a long way to get to it, was like, I see the Kelly Gang as a punk band. We're going to let go of the history. We're not going to be penned in by this idea of who he was. We're going to do our own version. And I think these boys are punks. I think they're angry, ambitious, confused, excitable, youthful young men. So I want you to form a band, and I've booked you a gig in 3 weeks from now in a bar in Melbourne. And so we formed a band, and we wrote songs, and that was our main rehearsal, to get listening to each other and get sharing to each other, you know, poems, lyrics, you know, to put yourself out there, who's singing, who's playing guitar, who's playing keyboard, who's drums, like, and sharing these songs. And then we performed a gig in a bar as a band ourselves. And we also, You know, we did it kind of with nods to what these, the armor that the men wear in the script, which is they dress like banshees from Ireland. So we did it in these old dresses that we used to rehearse in. And it was the most amazing experience, because then you walk in the next day with this swagger of like, of like, we just played a gig. Yeah. We just played a gig at the Gasso. You know, songs we wrote. And two of the songs are in the film, actually. So it was... That was an amazing experience.
And did that help you at all kind of going into 1917, which came straight after, didn't it?
Yeah, it really did. It really did, because I think the experience of making the true history of the Kelly Gang was so rigorous in a lot of ways. The rigor that came with 1917, I felt sort of match fit physically, for one, the physicality of it, and emotionally as well. And also, I was actually talking about it with Justin just before, because we just met downstairs, that emotionally, I don't think I could have played Schofield without the experience of Ned, because when I auditioned for Schofield very soon after I got home from The True History of the Kelly Gang, and towards the last few weeks of the shoot, we were doing a particular sequence in the film, which is really intense. And I basically was like, I had only the energy to do it. And I know that sounds sort of wanky, but I remember thinking like, I felt really on the edge. And I was like, I can do my job absolutely fine. But if we talk about home, which I'm really missing at the minute, I won't be able to function out here. I'll fall apart and I won't be able to do my job. I can do my job if we don't talk about home. I can only do this right now. And that is what I think is the crux of Schofield. Or for me, and my very first audition scene before I read a script was a scene between Schofield and Blake, where Blake's going, what about your home? Why don't you take your medal there? Like, what about home? Why don't you take it back? And Schofield's thing is like, don't. And he tries to open up. When he does, he almost goes. He fears he's going to unravel. Whether he does or if he doesn't, he thinks, I can't even test that. And that, for me, I felt that very much at the end of Ned.
Are there any skills you've kind of developed for any film role that you've kind of kept on?
Still do a bit of yoga from Captain Fantastic. Did a lot of yoga for that one, and still do nowhere near as much, but still do that a little bit. I've really enjoyed writing, actually, from Ned. That's something that I've always enjoyed, but it was Justin. That's the beauty of this job, is that people offer you opportunities to kind of do a lot of the things that you would love to try, but either don't have the guts or the means to do it, to kind of take ownership over that want to do it. And writing was one of those things.
And you mentioned Captain Fantastic earlier. Was there anything you took away from working with Viggo?
I mean, Viggo's amazing and a lovely man. But I think in terms of his craft, which was relevant to 1917, is I've never seen an actor who's got such a three-dimensional awareness of the entire process of filmmaking, of what they're involved in. And I thought, you know, because I'd heard about how focused he is as an actor, and I kind of thought that that meant that he would never break from character, that he was always inside of the character, and that's where the goodness of his work comes from. And that's why Ned was an interesting process, because that's the most that I've ever felt a character blur the lines with myself in the doing of it. And Viggo, I was so surprised and impressed with his level of awareness of everyone on set. And without encroaching on other people's jobs, he helped build the set. He helped provide costumes. He brought clothes from his own home. If he felt like he'd missed something in a take, but he knew that there was limited time, that we were on a bus and we only had one long take, he would go back and he would offer up another angle with his body and say, Matt, I'm just going to offer two angles on this one. Like, he had an idea of the edit. He had an idea of the production design. He had an idea of costume. He had an idea of performance. He had an idea of the sound. He was so... had such a three-dimensional awareness. And that's what 1917 taught me, is the benefit of knowing how the camera's seeing you, knowing what the cameraman needs, knowing how the set has facilitated that for both of you, knowing the amount of people who have built that set in the first place. Everything is a mutual handoff. Viggo embodied that. And so I'm so excited to see, you know, his film that he's now written and directed, because I think, you know, that three-dimensional awareness, I think will just has to tip over into him being a great filmmaker.
Yeah. And just a very quick one to end on. As you're a young British actor, I could not ask you, and you've worked with Daniel Craig in the past as well, would you consider throwing your name in the ring for the Bond gig when he
I don't know if it's for me to throw my name in. I feel I'm a bit young for Bond, isn't it? I think, I mean, it's Bond. You couldn't not consider it, could you? Yeah. It's like going on a date with the Queen. You kind of go, I don't know if it's necessarily the right thing to do, but I you think you have to, don't you? Like, I don't
know. The one after next, maybe. Then.
Yeah. I don't know. We'll see.
Okay, so that's George talking about his preparation for playing Ned Kelly. What do we think? You and I saw it in Toronto Film Festival, Matt. It was very well received there. People really enjoyed this sort of psychedelic sort of looking at the narrative that we write for ourselves and that society writes for us, and the sort of the clash of those two things. Does it work? Is this a return to form for Justin Kersal.
For me, it very much is. It's very much him back on sort of Snowtown, Macbeth territory. Mm. Like you say, yeah, it's a very, very intense film, sort of led by a very intense performance by George Mackay. And it really, really worked for me. Like, I love the fact you get this big build up, kind of the whole first act is basically his childhood.
Because it's split into three sections, isn't it? Boy, man, and then the final section is this very famous standoff he had with the police.
Yeah.
When he built his own armour and his gang wore their own armour. So it's set in three sections.
I mean, it's not the most mainstream film. It's not the easiest film to watch. It is kind of, yeah, it's intense. It's full on. It's not a traditional biopic in any sense of the word, but there really is a lot you can get out of it if you're into it.
Yeah, I mean, and the cinematography is amazing. Oh, it's a beautiful looking film. There's a lot of stroboscopic kind of scenes with a sort of flashing lights and black and white. The gang all look very modern. They all look like they should be in a Jack White band together. They're all sort of wearing anachronistic clothing. They wear these dresses. It's very much a feast for the eyes, but for me, it didn't quite work. It felt a little bit like very, we are making art with a capital A, and I didn't really get the emotional heft of it. So it left me feeling a bit cold, I'm afraid. But reviews out of Toronto were very, very good. And when I spoke to Justin Kersal out there, he was just sort of really thrilled to get back to something that was his wheelhouse and his own country and to talk about Australians as an identity. And Ned Kelly seems very much part of that. Is it something you fancy seeing, Matthew?
Yeah, I think so, yeah. I mean, how does it compare to the Heath Ledger, Orlando Bloom?
Well, I would say it's considerably better than that.
Oh, really? Yeah.
That one very much stuck to the biopic formula.
Yeah,
didn't
I remember
it?
That.
I love Heath Ledger, but yeah, it was very straight-laced kind of biopic. Whereas
this is a bit more daring.
I personally love the way it dug into that whole myth-making thing. And I just found that really fascinating. But it's just isn't the most conventional film. So it's not the easiest viewing.
And this, the bucket head.
You do get the bucket heads, of course. That's myth. But what you do get in this one is Russell Crowe being sort of quite farty and corpulent, a sort of Falstaff figure to young Ned. And we haven't really seen him in a film for a while, so it was quite nice to see him doing his thing.
He's very good, and he sings a very rude song, which
very
is very
rude
funny.
Song.
This is getting better and better.
Actually, as well, you mentioned him, but there's a really great support cast in this as well, because Essie Davis, who is Justin Kersal's wife in real life, she plays Ned's mother. She's fantastic in it. Mm. And again, equally kind of as intense as George Mackay, I'd say.
Charlie Hunnam's very good as well.
Charlie Hunnam's great in a small role. Nicholas Hoult, possibly
really
one of his
good.
Best roles as this sleazy, is he a constable?
He is a constable. Yeah. Be careful how you say that.
that kind of relates to Russell Crowe's song then.
Yes.
And
back into that.
He's very much sort of channeling his sort of co-star in About a Boy, isn't he? He's sort of pulling a sort of Hugh Grant in this. Sort of sardonic and snarky, but just horrible. Dandy-ish, a horrible character. Yeah, very dandyish.
Like he was in The Favourite.
Yes, similar tone there. I think Charlie Hunnam's great. I love what he does. But this is, I think, the first time we've seen him act with his natural accent since Biker Grove.
Yeah.
And he also plays a very horrible person. And when I spoke to Justin, the thing he said that he liked was the dichotomy of putting, you know, people who are as handsome as Nicholas Hoult and Charlie Hunnam in these roles of absolutely despicable men to make the audience really question, you know, how they feel and to keep the audience off balance. And it really does work because you would not expect those two actors to play such horrible people.
No, they're quite challenging then.
Yeah, like, I mean, just the fact that Justin Kersal can attract those caliber of names for such small roles kind of really adds to the sort of character of the film.
It feels like a really classy piece of work, doesn't it? I know I didn't particularly gel with it, but I think a lot of people will enjoy it. Okay, so that's True History of the Kelly Gang, which is out on the 28th of February. So let's move on from one intense period piece to another.
Elle vous attend. Ça fait des années que je rêve de faire ça. Mourir. Courir.
So that's Portrait of a Lady on Fire, Celine Siema's gorgeous story of two women in Victorian France. Give me a little bit more background, Matt. What else is this about?
So basically, in terms of the plot, We have a painter called Marianne, played by Noémie Melon, and she's kind of sent to this isolated house where she's got to try and paint a portrait of Eloise, played by Adèle Haenel. And Eloise has been very resistant to having a portrait painted in the past, because basically so she can be set up with a suitor, so a suitor can see what she looks like before he meets her.
Mm.
And she's not keen on this idea. And so this new painter, Marianne, has been brought in to kind of get her...
Sneakily
paint her, basically. So she's not going to sit down and pose, but she's going to inveigle her way into her sort of friendship and look at her through the day, commit it to memory and sort of paint it at night. That's how the kind of setup of the story starts.
That's not all that happens, is it?
That's not all, no. And it's not a spoiler to say... Very, very gradually, a romance blooms between the two. And that's what you really need to know in terms of the plot before going in. But it's very much 2/3-hander, because there is another young girl in the house who is a supporting role, but quite a pivotal one, who's like the kind of maid around the house. But very much it's Marianne and Eloise who are the kind of main two characters that you really focused on, and it's just those three in the house, so it feels very isolated. It's kind of beautiful landscapes. It feels very much it's just those two. And yeah, it's really intense, but really great film.
It's a 5-star movie from Total Film. What else about it makes it a 5-star movie? Mm.
It's a slow burner.
I mean, I was planning to make that pun earlier as well.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of gradually ratchets up the tension. It's very classy, it's very elegant, very subtle. Very, very literary.
Very romantic.
Yeah, very romantic, yeah. The film's really kind of stayed with me. I didn't enjoy it so much as I was watching it. I kind of did more admire it than enjoy it, I have to say. But it did definitely stay with me. And yeah, I think it's incredibly well made.
And yeah, it's very, very romantic in that whole thing of like the stolen glances and the unspoken. If you're into that, it very much delivers on that front.
Yeah.
And without going into any sort of spoilers or anything, I actually really like the ending. It has... like the way it kind of works out and what you see kind of happens eventually. That really worked for me. I think that was partly why it also stuck with me a lot as well after seeing it, because it was quite a while ago I actually saw this, but has stuck with me a lot. It's definitely one of my favourites of the year so far.
I didn't really find it that emotionally involving.
I actually did, to be honest. I had the opposite experience where,
cold.
Again, you have this sort of sense that because she's on a limited kind of engagement, she's there to kind of fulfil this assignment and that's what she's there to do. And you know her time's relatively limited. There was that sense for me of the clock ticking and these people you kind of desperately knew you wanted to be together, and you knew that there was a fairly limited time frame for it. So for me, that kind of kept me hooked in. And I'm always a sucker for that when there's just time limit on a romance, basically. Yeah.
Well, we know, because you love your Before Sunrise and Before Sunset. Yeah. Also, this film is not just sort of, it has a lot to say about creativity and art and women's place within art, because, you know, obviously it sort of talks about the patriarchal society that they're living in and the fact that this is a female painter painting a woman, and that day and age women were not allowed to paint men. Do you think it has something to say on that level as well, not just romantic?
Oh yeah, definitely. And it's also kind of, you mentioned the painting, obviously that's a key part of it, and it's a bit of a cliche to say, but it is a very painterly looking film. The film lives up to this sort of artistic vision, and you don't get really long, sort of boring scenes of this, but it is really fascinating when you just see the paints going on the canvas.
Yeah.
And there's just something really mesmerizing about it, I found, with that. And I just love that side of it as well.
There's a lovely scene on the beach as well with fire in it. No spoilers. There is fire in
but,
this movie.
You know, this is called Portrait of a Lady on Fire. So there is fire of the heart and physical fire going on.
And even despite that kind of, the sort of political and cultural resonance you were talking about, I found it a very accessible film. It's a very, very easy film to watch. And obviously there's the subtitle, the 1-inch barrier of the subtitles.
Yes.
But it's very easy to watch. And don't be put off, I don't think, if you think, it sounds too art house or too, it sounds quite, heavy going foreign language film.
Yeah.
It's very easy to watch.
And there's no male roles in it either, are there? Like, if I'm remembering correctly.
I don't think so, no.
Or if there is, it's very tiny.
I think it's pretty much it. Like I said, it's mostly that sort of three-hander, and you get Eloise's mum early on when she's kind of setting up the assignment, but then she disappears for most of the
film.
Valeria Golino.
Yeah, from Hot Shots and Rain Man. I don't think I'd seen her on screen for a while.
Of course,
So that was nice
to
see her.
If you didn't know if you fancied seeing this, what other films would you suggest that, if you liked those films, that you would like this film? What would you be talking about? Vertigo, perhaps a bit of Hitchcock because of the sort of...
Maybe, I mean, there's not kind of suspense as such with that or shock or
one that comes
thrills
to mind.
as such. But I could see that. I can definitely see that in terms of the themes.
And one that comes to mind for me is The Age of Innocence, Martin Scorsese's film. That really sort of paired back romance where, again, it's all
just
in the sort
kiss
of subtle
on a wrist
glances,
is
exactly,
so hot.
And that's what springs to mind when I think of a film like this.
And obviously Siema's film Girlhood, if you liked her work there, then I think probably this continues that in a different way, but in very much a similar theme.
Movie.
Yeah. Okay, great. I am totally going to see this. So this is out also on February the 28th. What a bumper day that is for movies.
There's so much to choose from.
Yes. And we're not done yet, because we also have this one, which is also coming out. Another film about hidden nasties. Todd Haynes' true life procedural thriller, Dark Waters, which just might be the scariest film of the year. Let's have a listen.
I am a corporate defense attorney.
So?
I defend chemical companies.
Well, now you can defend me.
How many did you lose?
190.
190 cows.
You tell me nothing's wrong here.
It's a small matter for a family friend. Help a guy who needs it.
The farmer or you? That's chemicals, I'm telling you.
I'm seeing documents. I don't understand. They're hiding something. That chemical. What if you drank it?
Drank it?
It's like saying, what if I swallowed a tire? What if whatever's killing those cows is in the drinking water?
Dark Waters, when I hear of it, I think it's like some sort of terrible lake that maybe zombies live in. It's not.
I think this is worse.
This is actually even more terrifying, because this is what, Matt?
It actually almost starts in that vein with kind of skinny dipping teens going into a lake. So it does almost, whether intentionally or not, set up that feeling of a horror film. To sum this up, this is the new film from Todd Haynes, who has done really varied stuff throughout his career. Obviously, Jane, you love Velvet Goldmine.
I love Velvet Goldmine.
We all love Carol. And so Dark Waters, on the surface, almost doesn't really sound like the film you'd expect Todd Haynes to make, because it's a sort of true life procedural and it sounds very straightforward.
It sounds dry.
It does sound very dry. And it's the true story of this guy called Rob Billett, who's a corporate lawyer. And he basically ends up taking on chemical giant DuPont in a kind of massive class action lawsuit. So yeah, so far, so very dry. What's really fascinating is how this lawsuit sort of relates to things we all know in our everyday lives, particularly Teflon and nonstick and that kind of thing, and just all the environmental negative impacts of that. It's just one of those exceptionally well-made films, I found. I kind of went into it with low expectations, thinking, yeah, it just sounds a bit dry, what's the point in this? But it's so gripping and it's so so scary, just the reach of this sort of this corporation and all the rubbish that was being pumped out into the environment.
It makes you want to throw your frying pans straight in the bin.
You won't look at your nonstick pans in the same way once you've seen this. And also, it's at the center Mark Ruffalo, who is obviously kind of very passionate about his environmental causes in real life. He plays Rob, and it's a really, really great performance by him as well. Like, I was sort of
overlooked by the Academy and other awards bodies.
This whole film was completely overlooked, and I'm actually surprised that it just didn't get a bit more sort of awards heat this year at all, because it was just entirely overlooked. But
because it is in the sort of thing of Aaron Brockovich or Michael Clayton, it's that sort of film that traditionally, you know, awards people would love
Oscars,
a real life story and sort of this David and Goliath scenario. And I don't know why it sort of disappeared in all the noise this season. So we definitely want to go see it, because it's a 4-star movie according to Total Film, because it's so accomplished, it's so tense, it makes a dry subject seem very fascinating. And it's also actually something that we can all actually relate to. You may think you don't, but we all do have a Teflon pan in our cupboard, and probably we should be thinking about what we're going to do with them.
Going to eye it with suspicion from now on.
Yeah.
And and just the way the kind of corporate behavior and that kind of thing is put under the microscope, that just feels so relevant to now. And the film spans around a decade, and it's really sort of elegantly done the way you kind of move through the years. And like I say, Ruffalo, I think it's one of his best performances in years, actually.
He's got some other big names, hasn't he? He's got Anne Hathaway and Tim Robbins.
They're kind of much smaller roles, really, but still, very good. And again, it sort of just adds to the general feeling of class, really, around this film.
So it feels like there's a lot of intelligent movies to watch Friday.
Yeah.
You've got all sorts of different genres, different subjects, different styles, but they all seem to be like they're not dumb movies, which is quite a treat.
Even The Invisible Man, which is far and away the sort of mainstream release of the week. I'm sure that'll be the biggest hit of the week.
Yeah.
But I personally would heartily recommend all the four films we've discussed.
Yeah, it's a good lineup.
Well, let us know what you go and see this weekend. We'd like to hear your opinion and whether you thought The Invisible Man bottled the ending. Let's move on now to our Is It Just Me section, which is a regular in the magazine where somebody with an opinion that an may outlier. Or not be shared yeah. by other people argues the toss on something. And this one is about Blade Runner 2049, which Matt posits is better than the original.
Yep, I all right, there. Okay. I went there.
Court is open. Go on. Why is this one better than the original, which is so beloved by people?
The original is beloved. And I have to say straight off the bat, you can read my full argument online at gamesradar.com/totalfilm. But to give you the gist, I've always found the first one a film that I admire more than love. I kind of really respect how it was so groundbreaking in terms of its world building and its design. But I've seen the film at least sort of four times, but I've never been entirely gripped by the actual story itself. I'm just kind of admiring the production design and the world building. Whereas when Blade Runner 2049 came along, I just found that kind of, one, the detective story at the center, I just found so gripping. Two, I found the visuals kind of equally good. Obviously, it's never going to feel as groundbreaking as it did back in 1982.
But it's still quite beautiful, isn't it?
Yeah, Roger Deakins. An Oscar,
yeah, exactly. Finally. Roger Deakins, Oscar-winning cinematography. And for me, one of the things that really pushed it over the original for me, which again, I like, despite saying, you know, I don't love, I do like it, but is Ryan Gosling as Kay. I just thought he was a character I was just invested in so much more emotionally than I was ever with Harrison Ford's Deckard. And that was kind of the point with Deckard. He was a bit sort of, you know, robotic in his emotions and whatnot, and, you know, perhaps not as passionate as Roy Batty, you know, and there was that sort of contrast between them. But it didn't really, at the same time, help me to invest in Deckard and his journey. And also that the ambiguity that lies at the center of the first Blade Runner, is he or isn't he a replicant? I sort of almost don't really care if he's so dull anyway. so emotionless.
I don't think Harrison Ford cares either.
From what he said, he doesn't.
Whereas throughout Blade Runner 2049, I was so rooting for
Kay. You wanted him.
Yeah, you just so want him to discover
that wooden horse to be.
Exactly, yeah.
And thing.
Ryan Gosling's just so good at having that emotion kind of bubbling under the surface while he's kind of holding it all back inside. But you can just see it all there on his face and in his eyes without him, you know, ever going over the top or launching into any sort of histrionics or anything like that. I just loved it. And for
so
those
it's more
reasons,
for you, it's more emotionally fulfilling and performance wise, perhaps more.
Yeah. More satisfying as just a film to watch, I suppose. Yeah. Obviously, you'd never be as groundbreaking as the first, but. Yeah. Come on, what do you guys think? Is it just me?
Yes.
I think it is just you. I think a lot of people would say the same. Blade Runner original is so iconic. And there's pretty much nothing wrong with it. I don't agree that he's boring and robotic. I think that's part of the sort of the mystery of him.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that even now, we still don't really know, is he or isn't he?
Mm.
And, you know, you mentioned Batty there. Such an amazing scene with the I've seen things, you know, and Teardrops in the Rain. And Rutger Hauer was so amazing in that role. I loved Blade Runner 2049.
Mm.
And I loved that it was so faithful to everything that had happened in the previous film and that it built upon it. But for me, it was just that. It was an extension of something I loved dearly and not better. It was just something I liked a lot and liked as much as I would never say I loved it more. What about you?
Yeah, I would say the same. It was hugely impressive. And, you know, as one of these belated sequels, I mean, it got a lot of things right, but I just felt the characters just weren't as engaging as Rachel and Roy and Pris in the original. Yeah, they are just such instant icons, where I think this really strives for that, but just doesn't quite make it.
However, I have to say, having been in Gran Canaria during one of the worst sandstorms
you've lived in,
in 40 years, I may reevaluate how I feel about Blade Runner 2049 with that orange dust thing that's going on in the film, because that's exactly what I experienced. It was very Blade Runner. So yeah, Matt, I think it's just you. But let's see. Maybe people will be tweeting at you. What's your Twitter handle?
It's at Matt Matum.
Come on.
Let me know if you're on my side.
Come at him. So that's it for this episode. There's just time for one other question from a reader. This is Nicola Langdon. And she wants to know if it's as fun being a film journalist as it seems.
Yes.
That's a wide open question.
It's very wide open question, Nicole.
Absolutely.
Ultimately, you have to say yes.
Yes.
What's just been the most fun thing you've done?
Oh, there's too many to mention, really. Mm. Just too many great set visits and interviews. But yeah, of course, you get certain things you could gripe about with any job, but you don't get to talk about films all day and you don't get to see films early and all that kind of thing in other jobs. So yeah, I'd say it's as fun as it seems.
Yeah, it's just the whole immersion in film, and there's always something coming up to be excited about as well.
Yeah, I think in this spoiler culture, one of our greatest privileges in this job is, like you say, seeing films before anyone else has seen them. So you see them exactly as the filmmaker would like audiences to see them, with no critique, no comment, nothing attached to them, no expectation. You see them at such an early stage that you just have this amazing experience.
And that's incredible.
Yeah, that's incredible when you see films like Blade Runner 2049 or something like that. And it's a wonderful feeling. And so that is why we don't do spoilers on this podcast or in MAG, because we would love for people who go and see films to have something like that experience, because it's really lovely, isn't it? Going into a film, knowing nothing and having it unfurl before your eyes.
And getting free sandwiches.
Sometimes.
Yeah, not as many as usual.
And sometimes a warm glass of red wine in a plastic cup.
Or an entire pizza.
Yeah, which has been known. We're not looking gift horse mouth. We're very, very grateful for those things. Okay, as always, don't forget, there is 10% off Total Film subscriptions with the code
InsideTF.
Yeah, at checkout at www.myfavoritemagazines.co.uk. So please come and get a subscription and join us. That's it from us. Please join us next time for our podcast next Thursday. But for now, it's time to say goodbye, boys.
Bye.
Bye.
Goodbye.
I'm the Invisible Man. I'm the Invisible Man. Incredible how you can.